and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie, and with Arlene Englehart, who is coming, clunking around.
Sorry about that. I was taking a picture of Lisa so I can post it.
Well, we might as well introduce her. Lisa Perry, one of our favorite activists in the community, is here with us, too, and we're going to be getting up to snuff on the protests that are going to go on tomorrow. A lot of people are really engaged, as in my opinion they really seriously should be, about an emergency declaration by Trump. And so, and then also we're going to be talking about HR1, which is really, really important. So it's going to be an exciting time with Lisa. And also, well, on the phone we're going to have Melinda Schmidt, and she's with Organizing America. And then after that, is sexism already raising its little head?
And in case you haven't figured it out, this is from a woman's point of view on WMNF.
Maybe I should start all over from the top.
Well, that's usually my line. But I was not quite over here at that point.
Okay. Well, what can I say? Things are happening so fast that one cannot possibly keep up. And so I am actually going to put this little music on. And I absolutely love your T-shirt, Lisa Perry.
Thank you so much.
she's got the one and only great RBG.
And as soon as I get her picture posted, people will be able to see it on Facebook.
Yeah, and then she wrote that marvelous opinion yesterday, the majority opinion, talking about the illegality of confiscating people's property and the fines involved, you know, before the person's even been, maybe charged, but certainly not found guilty, or, you know, the innocence or guilt hasn't been adjudicated.
And aren't you going to be talking to one of the authors of the book, RBG?
I am indeed. That's going to be coming up. Erina Cardin is one of the authors of the notorious RBG. And she is actually going to be the keynote speaker for Planned Parenthood, their big fundraiser, which I'm pretty sure is April 19th. But I'm sorry, I don't have that date right in front of me. And so we will be having Erina. We've got her confirmed. We just don't have totally the date confirmed. It will either be live on the show at the end of March, or it will be the first or second week of April, but she will be on, and I think it's exciting, and I'm so glad that she's coming for Planned Parenthood, because all such worthy causes that are so necessary. So, anyway, but I'm also excited. I was able to talk to Amanda Hunter, and she is from the Barbara Lee Family Foundation. And they've done a lot, actually, of data and statistics following sexism and women running for office, mainly governor, but also Congress, state legislatures, et cetera. And I think you're going to be interested in some of that information. So, but with that in mind, I'm just going to put on this little music, because I feel like this kind of a mood today, you know, with the National Emergency Declaration and the very serious threat that is to our democracy. And so many others. So I'm going to put this on by Laura Nero, and then we will also then get Melinda, because she's going to be on the phone, and then we will start. So let's hear a little bit of Laura Nero. She's going to try and save the country, as Lisa and so many others are too. So, okay, let's give a little listen here.
Precious.
I just couldn't resist that, leaving that on. I love that sound because I feel like that so many times anymore. Don't you, Lisa, that kind of primal scream? And I am also happy because with us on the phone is Melinda Schmidt, and she is with Organizing America. So, Melinda, welcome so much to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
Before we get started, I'm going to play this. I've got this little clip from Elizabeth Whiten. I think that's how I'm pronouncing her name. I'm probably doing it very incorrectly, but it's G-O-I-T-E-I-N. And she's at the Brennan Center. She's a fantastic lawyer. And she probably knows as much about the Emergency Securities Act as any person actually in this country. And she has written some marvelous articles, not just for the Brennan Center, and in professional journals, but also in the Atlantic. But she has put this little promo out. And so let us air that. And then we will start to talk with both Lisa Perry and you. So let's just air this.
Powers available to the president during a national emergency are ripe for abuse. Congress should act now to rein them in before President Trump or a future president uses them to undermine our democracy. Unknown to most Americans, Congress has over the years passed more than 100 provisions of law that give the president increased powers the moment he declares a national emergency. This decision is left entirely to the president's discretion. There's no legal definition of emergency, no requirement that Congress ratify the decision, and no judicial review. Many other laws expand the president's powers during specific types of emergency, like war or public health crises, even without a formal declaration. I co-direct the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and we've been conducting a comprehensive review of emergency powers. Some of them are formidable. For instance, during a national emergency, the president can shut down radio stations or take them over. If there's a threat of war, he can go further and take over facilities for wire communication. That law was last used during World War II, when most American households didn't even have a telephone. Today, it could be interpreted to allow the president to assert control over internet traffic inside the United States. Simply by proclaiming a mere threat of war, President Trump could shut down websites, block emails, and alter search results. Another law, called the Insurrection Act, allows the president to deploy military troops inside the U.S. to suppress any unlawful combination or conspiracy that's obstructing the execution of the law. Once again, the statute doesn't define those terms. President Eisenhower used this law to enforce desegregation in Arkansas schools, but it's vague enough to be used against political protesters or undocumented migrants. In theory, if Congress decides the president has gone too far, it can vote to terminate a state of emergency. But that would require a veto-proof majority, and Congress hasn't even attempted such a vote in more than 40 years. In practice, we've been relying on presidents to exercise self-restraint and hoping that the courts will step in if they don't. That's a gamble we can no longer take. Invoking emergency powers is a standard move for authoritarians seeking to consolidate power, like the Philippines' Duterte or Turkey's Erdogan. These are the very same rulers Trump has said he admires. If President Trump feels that his hold on the White House is threatened, either by an election or by impeachment, he might just follow their example. Congress needs to fix our system of emergency powers to provide better protections against abuse. It should put strict time limits on presidentially declared states of emergency. And it should revise emergency powers to ensure that they don't threaten Americans' fundamental rights and freedoms. This Congress is unlikely to do all that, but forward-looking committee chairs can launch the process by reviewing existing emergency declarations and powers. The time to get started on reform is now, before emergency powers create an emergency for our democracy.
Well, she actually made that little promo talking about some of the work they were doing before this happened. And so,
oh, wow.
It's pretty. She's very, very powerful. She's very intelligent, and she's done a lot of work on it. And I've seen her referred to by a lot of people this week. And I hope to get her on the show if we can. I'm certainly working on it because, you know, that it is amazing, Lisa and Melinda, you know, that most of us aren't constitutional experts. And, you know, that. It's 200 years, really, in terms of history, isn't a lot of time, but, you know, there's a lot of kind of dusty areas that aren't spelled out. And sometimes if you put a certain person that he can walk into these dusty old rooms and think, oh, wow, look at this, oh, my. And I think, really, that our sense of common decency, you know, and the kind of character and moral opprobrium we expect from our leaders, we have to spell them out. And I think this really alerts us to the real dangers and the power this president of the United States really has. And doesn't it give you a chill? I mean... And Lisa, you and I were talking before the show. You know, when people say, "Oh, well, then if he's allowed to do it, the Democrats can do it," and you know, it just back and ball like a ping pong match. But it's far more of a serious, actually, a democratic crisis. Than that. And we really need to take this very, very seriously.
I think what we're seeing is a transition from the election in 2016, where a lot of the activist communities were concerned with protecting progressive interest, and now we are having a much more serious conversation about protecting democracy in general. And just the fact that our Congress, the citizens, basically everyone needs to get involved and realize that this affects each and every single one of us, and it isn't a partisan issue. So looking at bills like H.R. 1, as we had mentioned earlier in the show, that can help protect components of democracy for our citizens, also create some checks and balances that, quite frankly, none of us realized aren't there until we have someone that's in an administration that is testing these boundaries, that is not using self-restraint, and it's getting very scary.
Lisa, I don't know, you know, I was watching last night and I was hearing McCabe talk about, you know, the Russian investigation. And it was absolutely chilling. And Nicole Wallace did a fantastic interview with him earlier in the day. And I caught part of it. And I thought it was really chilling when he was saying in the FBI, when they realized how serious these apparent, events were, that they were trying to let everybody they possibly could, even with security clearances that ordinarily wouldn't have access to this information, to try and get checks and balances because they realize the real seriousness of this challenge. And I find, actually, with H.R. 1, you know, I think there's been so much attention to the Green New Deal, and there should be. I love some of the stuff they're suggesting. But H.R. 1, I don't know if it's quite gotten all of the attention it really deserves, and it's almost like the suppression. And frankly, there has been such a political suppression of opposition in this country for several years. And even during the Obama administration, even when he was president, he fought nonstop against McConnell and Paul Ryan, you know, and McConnell openly saying you're going to be a one-term president, just a no, no, no.
Right.
And so I think it was kind of that slow erosion, and we didn't realize just how bad it had gotten. And it was just like, you know, the first bill that the Democrats put out, H.R. 1, it was almost like an explosion of all the things that they have seen has gone so wrong, you know, essentially with voting, with corruption, with ethics, you know, and with financing, and 531-page bill.
Right.
But Rachel Maddow said it very well. She said this could change everything.
It really could. And that's one of, I think that you pointed out, you know, H.R. 1 has kind of not gotten as much of the recognition as, let's say, the Green New Deal has. But when we start spelling out for citizens what H.R. 1 includes, then, you know, I think that it excites more than just the left. It should excite citizens in general. And it would really lend to fighting for democracy and restoring some of that balance. And Melinda and I have been talking about it because we do have the event tomorrow to highlight H.R. 1. And Melinda, do you want to talk about some of the you know, more poignant portions of yes. H.R. 1?
Well, sure. First, I mean, the piece that aired earlier is just a perfect segue into where we are now. And it explains so well the crisis that we're in, which is basically having the Trump and his presidency and his administration and all the actions they've taken. And for the entire year last year, the Congress said if we were able to take back the House, the Democrats in Congress, that they would propose this bill and present it. And they did. And there are things in the bill that really we haven't had to address before, like a president giving their taxes. You know, things that normally have been done in the past are not being done now. And it is a real attack on our democracy. But this has been 20 or 30 years in the making. A lot of this stuff didn't happen overnight or over 1 year. Trump is our president because things were not working properly. And they have things in this bill like having automatic voter registration, same-day voter registration. How awesome would that be? You know, just to be able to register to vote when you get your driver's license would make it so much easier. And they're trying to get more protections on improperly purging voter rolls or for example, if you don't vote in an election, you know, one missing one might be okay, but if you miss a few and mm-hmm. are on a list to be taken off the rolls, those things are all addressed in the voter empowerment and access part of the bill. But they also get into money and politics. So the goal is to take democracy back and give it to the American people. Take it back from big corporations and big money and give it back the power to the people. And we'll go over some of those things at our event tomorrow. But they also get into ethics and corruption. And another big thing that you know, don't talk about very much or hear about is gerrymandering and redistricting. And that is going to be such a huge issue for us because the new districts are going to be drawn in 2021. It's like, wow, that's a long way away. But it's not, because we have to start enacting legislation now to get the districts drawn fairly. So by this bill having it as a part of the comprehensive plan that they have, it's being talked about now, and we could get, if we had a national plan on how to draw districts fairly, it would really help on a state-by-state level, because you wouldn't have to go in and try to reinvent the wheel and go through all the court cases that you have to get districts drawn fairly. So that's just a brief overview, and I'm sure we can. We've got a great bit of links that we can share, so it can be posted, I presume, on the Facebook page or something like that. But tomorrow, we're actually going to ask for a call to action where people can write their members of Congress, and I can do that later in the in our show here. But it's just a text that you can do via your phone, so you don't even have to go to the computer or anything. If you're out taking a lunch break, you just pull out your phone and text Congress to 50409, and we're going to have a template, because we're going to reach out to members of Congress who are not supporting H.R. 1. Currently, there is not one Republican signed on to H.R. 1. So that's pretty representative of what the problem is, because this is not about, this should not be about Democrats. It should be Democrats, Republicans, Independents, everyone should sign on to this bill. And if they don't like one component of it, then, you know, just do what we're supposed to do to write bills. The Senate should propose a plan, and we could work on this together and pass legislation for the entire country that works for everyone.
Melinda, I'm really excited. You sound like you're just an excellent resource. And this really excites me. And so just for the listeners, the event we're talking about is tomorrow at, what, 5 o'clock, isn't it?
It's at 5:30 at Mirror Lake in St. Petersburg.
And, you know, that they're going to discuss, obviously, the National Emergencies Act and some aspects of that. But the HR 1, you know, that to me, what I didn't get through all 531 pages last night. But I was working as far as I could until my eyes and neck just gave out, and I thought I got to quit. But I am really excited because every aspect, you know, Citizens United and, you know, the dark money, so to speak, but also something that's not really discussed too much. And we see right now on the Supreme Court, we're looking, you know, at a Kavanaugh, and we're aware of the absolute necessity, unfortunately, of ethics, the establishment of ethics, not only for the president, but for Congress, for members of the Supreme Court and the cabinet. And this has never been the case before. And something that basic, and as you said, you know, voting day of actually voting, but also making it, you know, a national holiday, and also on federal elections wanting to have a paper ballot with random checks because there can be some kind of checks to make sure that it's not fraudulent. I mean, there are so many aspects in this bill that I was so impressed. As I say, to me, it's almost an explosion, you know, of what's been happening. And as you said, this didn't happen overnight, and it's so serious that there we have reached this point that we have to, you know, that Norquist and others wanted to reduce government to the size of, you know, a bathtub and pull the plug. Well, that's their definition of government, and I think we're realizing that we have to give our definition of government and democracy and fight just as long and hard. And so I'm so excited that you're going to be doing this tomorrow, because I think when people see this, I think they're really going to get excited and realize that there are so many aspects of this, but that everybody can fight for some part of it, because to me, this is what we need to, so to speak, give the necessary IV, if you will, the transfusion.
Right.
Yeah, that we need.
Just the bottom line is, no matter what your issue is, if you know, if you talk about the Green New Deal, that's really important. But if you are concerned about the climate, or if you want health insurance reform that works for everyone, or, you know, immigration, any of it is all touched by this. Because if we cannot get our democracy working for the people, to where our legislators are actually working for us and not lobbyists, and we're representing districts that are fair drawn districts, if all of that's not working, all of the issues are impacted by it. So this really is a number one bill that we need to be able to work on and get through Congress, both houses. We need to have legislation in the Senate. So we're actually, part of our call to action tomorrow is going to be asking, okay, this is hard to say, Senator Scott, in addition to Senator Nelson, I mean, Senator Rubio, see, I can't even, it's just boggling to me that we have two representatives now for our Senate that are both Republican, but we are going to beseech them to write a bill and co-sponsor it in the Senate to try to get a partner bill to this House bill so we can get movement on it. Now, maybe they will not jump on board with that, but we are going to at least get them on the record saying that they are against these awesome reforms to our democracy.
And now, isn't the Sarbanes the one that is sponsoring this so far in Congress?
Well, they
Representative Sarbanes, isn't he the one that's sponsored by it? Isn't he one of the sponsors?
Well, every Democrat in Congress are all co-sponsors of this bill.
Oh, wow. That really says it.
I've got a link that I can share later also that shows every state and who is on the bill and co-sponsoring it. And here locally, certainly Kathy Castor and Charlie Crist are both co-sponsors, which is really awesome that we have them here locally with us. So we'll be asking people to reach out to their representatives who are not co-sponsors of this bill, and asking them to sign on to it, because it's really important. And the more that we as citizens demand their participation and make our voices heard, that's the only way that we can get any traction, is to make sure they know where we stand. We can't just be quiet after an election. We have to do the work of democracy and make our voices heard.
And Melinda, as you said earlier, and again, we're talking to Lisa Perry and Melinda Schmidt, and we're talking about the event tomorrow that's going to be in St. Pete, 5:30 at Mirror Lake, and it's going to be a protest to Trump's declaration of the National Emergencies Act, but also H.R. 1, and I imagine you're also going to be discussing implementation of the felon voting to get their rights back voting.
Yep.
There's been, you know, and I don't know all that's being discussed, but I know that, and man, you are listening to that. And this is WMNF 885 Tampa. And, you know, as you said, and it's so important, but to me, this should be a bipartisan issue. I mean, voting and corruption, ethics, these are the standards that one should expect. And unfortunately, by the National Emergencies Act and other many, many other actions, it's being flaunted in our face that we have to spell out some of the ethics. We have to spell out some of the rules because we can't just trust the character and the moral of the certitude of the individual that's in office. And, you know, perhaps we've been remiss, but it's in our face. And you kind of, at this point, think that you hope there's enough people committed to this democracy that it's not too late.
And I think that it's really important to for us to continue to point out that this is a bill that applies to all citizens so that every vote is heard. And because you have so much Democratic support for this bill and a lack of Republican support, I am fearful that it could come across as, in some people's minds, as a partisan issue, but we need to really make the citizens understand what this bill is about and how it protects democracy for all of us, including the ethical aspect of it, getting dark money out of politics, making sure that you are registered to vote and you have that right, whether you choose to exercise it or not. You will not be improperly purged from the voting file. And I think that we are in a dangerous place where when we talk about a bill like this and you start to see this become a partisan issue, that gets really scary for me, because this is the fundamental cornerstones of our democracy, and we can't allow these types of topics to become so partisan.
Exactly. And it's the For the People Act is the name of it.
Yeah, that's so appropriate.
It's for everyone. And the other, just the follow up on what you're saying, Lisa, the messaging out there and the way that misinformation is shared, or the leader of our country will say things that are absolutely false. And, you know, we have to be the truth tellers and help people know what the truth is and make sure that this bill is represented as something that does impact everyone, because it does. It's not a one-sided political backed issue. It should be for everyone.
And again, it's tomorrow at Mirror Lake Park. I keep that's different than Williams Park, right?
It is, yes.
And you said links earlier, Melinda, because I think it's really important that people can spend some time. You know, democracy takes a little work and takes a little effort, but I imagine I came across all kinds of links where there is good information. And will you have all that there tomorrow so people can access that? Or in case people can't go tomorrow because of work or other things, what are some of the links that you suggest?
So there is a coalition nationally that has come together, and that is WeDemandDemocracy.org. And when you see the link, the list of all the different groups that are working together for this, it's really impressive. It's a very strong coalition. So that's the national website for this particular bill, the For the People Act. And then the other thing that I mentioned was a really quick way to be able to contact your representative. And that is by texting Congress to 50409. And it basically will send prompts and it will ask you, do you want to contact your representative or your senator? And it will do the open and close for your letter. And then you write, whatever language you want to write, and it will send it directly to them. It's already verified that you are a constituent. So it's a really quick way that you can send a message, and then you can also do a letter to the editor with that same program. And we'll be showing that tomorrow. We're actually going to get everyone to pull out their cell phones tomorrow at the end of the event as our call to action and help people write letters to their representatives on the spot tomorrow. So that'll be a really great thing that we're looking forward to doing.
Okay, Melinda Schmidt and Lisa Perry, anything else you want to say before I go into the next segment? I think it's a really important event, and it's a chance for democracy, people. So any other thing that we didn't mention, because we've gone through this very quickly?
Well, the main thing is show out, tell your friends to join us tomorrow at Mural Lake at 5:30, and spread the word about HR1, because I have mentioned it to so many people, and they don't even know anything about it. It's the For the People Act, and just check out the website, WeDemandDemocracy.org, for more information. And they can also, I think you can share our information after the call. I think we can be resources, and then they can get more information tomorrow. So please join us.
Okay, well, thank you so much for giving us this time today. I'm going to keep Lisa Perry in here for a little while. And good luck, and the weather should be great. So just a marvelous, kind of patriotic event. I think it sounds exciting.
Exactly.
So thank you. Thank you so much. You take care. Bye-bye. And again, you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Let's just hear this little promo, and we're going to go on. Well, I'm sorry about that. It doesn't seem to be playing. So anyway, we will come back to that a little bit later. Okay, well, you are listening again to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. And as I said earlier, I was able to catch up with Amanda Hunter. And we're, you know that... We already have at least 5 women who have declared. Pretty outstanding women, I think. And so naturally, people are watching already. And tell me, Lisa, you know, because the Barbara Lee Family Foundation has been doing research since, I think, over 20 years, you know, on women in politics and some of the obstacles they face, et cetera. And... You know, that I asked, and I really appreciate data. I really do, you know. It's
absolutely
very important. But, you know, I've been in science long enough to know that, you know, some of the things we're going to be talking about are very important. The biggest problem women fight is their likability.
Yep.
not their credentials, not their professionalism, et cetera. It's likability.
That's right.
And the statistics have shown that they can dislike a man, but if they think he's qualified, they'll vote for him. That the woman might be highly qualified, perhaps the most qualified they've ever had. If they don't like her, forget it. She's not going to get it.
That's absolutely right.
And also the difficulty of actually demonstrating their credentials. And, you know, that the guy just puts his resume and it's accepted. Well, of course. But she has to prove, you know. She has to prove that she really has not just done what's on her resume, so to speak, but that she has the smarts of it, that she has the experience of it, and all of these dilemmas. But you know that I'm listening to an AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and so many other, particularly of the young women. And here I'm going to go back to my experience in science. And, you know, common sense, we always think, shows us that things happen slowly, incrementally. You know, you would think by now that we realize, so what if you get a woman or an African-American in the top position? Somehow the other problems don't go away, you know, but still that doesn't count. But anyway, we tend to think that incrementally things change. All I know is that in science, that an electron just doesn't spin around the atom and then very slowly thinks, I want to be something different, so it's just going to edges this way out. No, it jumps.
It will jump, yes.
It happens all of a sudden. Boom. Same thing with a crystal. People could have worked throughout the world for years, maybe centuries, to try and manifest some crystal. When it happens in one lab, boom, all the rest of the world has it. Things happen quickly. They happen, you know, bang. They aren't incremental. And I kind of think that, you know, and I know this is data and it's very valid data and it's very real, but you know, when you listen to an orchestra, you think something's really happening, and I think the jump has already happened. And so I think it's up to all of us to say, that was then, this is now.
Yes.
You know, that this is kind of an absurd, judgmental rules that no longer apply. But anyway, just with that in mind, I don't mean in any way to undermine this interview. I did it. And I think she has a lot to say. But at the same time, life is happening every moment.
And so I agree.
You try and keep up. But anyway, I'm just going to play this by Amanda Hunter, and then we will come back. I am so happy to welcome to the show Amanda Hunter, and she is a communications director for the Barbara Lee Family Foundation, and they advocate women's equality and representation in American politics and in the field of contemporary art. So, Amanda Hunter, with this the year of our elections with five announced women candidates already, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's really impressive because your organization has been working for over 20 years, and it's kind of appropriate that here we are now, the 100th anniversary of getting the right to vote. It's kind of appropriate, don't you think?
We're very excited about the centennial for women's suffrage, so I'm glad you brought that up. Yes, it's very exciting.
Well, you know, Amanda, I have already noticed with the female candidates. Senator Warren, that she's already being called strident. And then with Gillibrand, they were debating, you know, whether she should use a fork to eat fried chicken. And it's always the problem for women candidates, isn't it? Their presentation.
Absolutely. Women are really treated differently when they run for office. And that is the biggest reason that Barbara started this foundation 20 years ago, because she wanted to empower all women at all levels to have the tools to succeed on the campaign trail.
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time on your website, and I strongly suggest people go there because you just have wonderful research.
Thank you.
And I really thought it was fascinating that, you know, that so many features that you bring out, that, in other words, women, to start with, they have this, quote, likability problem. And if you want something that is really subjective, just try and figure out what it is that people think that's likable in women.
Well, likability should be important for all candidates, and I know that every election cycle we all hear the same question, who would you rather have a beer with, and that's for candidates on both sides of the aisle, but our research shows that likability is more important for women candidates. In fact, it's critical, because we know that voters will vote for a man they do not like if they believe he's qualified, but they will not vote for a woman even if they believe she's qualified, if they don't like her. So it really depends on whether or not a voter will support a woman. She has to win them over, and she doesn't have much time to do so either. One of our studies showed that women only have 30 seconds to project confidence to voters, and confidence and likability are linked. So it's a lot like walking a tightrope for women in terms of likability, in a way that it is not for men. They barely have to worry about it.
And so you pretty much answered that, because I was just going to ask. You said women have 30 seconds to establish their likability, and there's no stopwatch on men's, apparently, likability.
Well, it's their confidence that they're projecting, that they have 30 seconds. But our advice for women, and you probably saw this, and I will give a shameless plug for everyone to visit our website, which is barbaraleefoundation.org, to read more, but likability is difficult to pin down. And some of the advice for women is things like share credit, but also take credit, use humor, but not too much humor, present well, but don't dress too nice, be strong, but not tough. And so we really compare it to walking a tightrope. And that's why at the end of the day, it comes down to authenticity. We know that authenticity is so important to voters. And when we saw a record number of women elected to office last year, we noticed that it was no accident that pretty much every woman that ran and won ran unapologetically as themselves, instead of trying to fit into an outdated template of what a candidate should look like.
Yeah, and most of them got really right out in the field. They knocked on doors. They really went in. They went to the meetings, et cetera. It seemed to me that the candidates who won really made an effort to really almost have eyeball-to-eyeball contact with their voters.
Absolutely, and part of that is because we know that women have to work twice as hard to get elected. So women tend to be more prepared. Even when you look at the women running for president, they all announced early. They all had their campaigns together. They had all their ducks in a row. And still, within hours of announcing, for most of them, we saw questions pop up from pundits and others. Can she win? Can she do it? When these women were more prepared than a lot of men that haven't even announced yet that they're running.
And, you know, I noticed that you were saying that to many voters, they want a woman who's been married, has kids. She's probably about 55. Her family's pretty successful. And yet, in a way, this is 1950s women. I mean, you're looking right now at AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And tell me, did you happen to hear Senator Warren, when she made her speech, and at the very end, she was saying, you know, handling problems, et cetera. And she talked about the accelerated pace that she had to potty train mm-hmm. her child in order that she could mm-hmm. get to law school. And I thought that was very telling when she was telling that, and I thought it seemed very well received by the audience.
It was fascinating. And what we found in our research is that what is very effective for women candidates is to be what we call 360-degree candidates, to bring the whole of their experience on the campaign trail and show voters who they are as people, not just give out their resume. And so what we've seen in the past few years has been a shift. Women showing windows into their personal life and talking about extended family and motherhood in a way that they may not have done 20 years ago. And you're absolutely right about families. We did research in 2017 called Modern Family that looked at how voters responded to various scenarios with women's personal lives and found that even though families have evolved so much since the 1960s, a lot of the stereotypes and views that voters hold are still so traditional. And in some cases, voters acknowledge that they were participating in a double standard when it came to things like asking who would take care of a candidate's young children if she was a woman and not the same for a male candidate. But then they still actively participated in their stereotypes anyway. So we're watching very closely to see if these years, last year and this coming year, and the momentum that's building will finally take down some of those stubborn stereotypes when it comes to women and their personal lives.
Yeah, I think, and again, we're talking to Amanda Hunter, and she's with the Barbara Lee Family Foundation. She's the communications director, and you are listening to WMNF in Tampa, Florida. And I really wonder, Amanda, with five already announced candidates and very, very qualified candidates, do you think that actually having this many women in the field is going to give a different perspective rather than just having one, and all the focus can be on that one, say, in the 16 other, like, Republican candidates? Do you think that's going to have a different effect on it?
Absolutely. The biggest effect that we're looking at is that for 20 years, we've heard participants in focus groups say, I would vote for a woman, just not that woman. And when you put a handful of highly qualified women into the field, it's a lot harder for people to hide their bias behind that excuse.
Yeah, and as you point out, I thought the research was fascinating that it's, you know, for the men to establish their qualifications, essentially all they have to do is present their resume. And if it's their title, they've done it. Where the women have to prove and show that they really do have abilities other than just the degrees or whatever. And these women are pretty well known. They've got records in the Senate. You know, they've got records that one can really look at. And I think in the present milieu we have right now, where the people see politics has becoming so dysfunctional, I think the attitude of a mom, whether it's a Nancy Pelosi or Elizabeth Warren, they put up with temper tantrums. They put up with kids, you know, stamping and saying, no, no, no. And in a way, the attributes they bring from rearing kids, et cetera, I think is a positive right now for a lot of voters.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and we know from our research that voters believe that women are in touch with their lives, and there's almost nothing more relatable than having a family, and certainly having children is a big piece of that, being able to balance everything that women need to think about when it comes to taking care of children and working, and also, in most cases, shouldering all of the emotional labor in a family, like planning birthday parties and all of the social things. And so women candidates do bring that asset when it comes to voters in a way that male candidates usually don't. But the other side of that, of course, because there always is one, is that people worry if a candidate has children, how they're going to balance doing the job, which is a little ridiculous when you look at the fact that most women in this country work outside the home these days. And even if they don't officially, they have a lot of other responsibilities in addition to taking care of their children.
And I really think it's interesting because, you know, so often, you know, I essentially do the women's show here. And I always make it a point, you know, pointing out that, you know, women's issues are human issues. Women's rights are human rights. And that, you know, when we're looking at the environment and the economy and wages and all of that, that even though I'm looking at it from a woman's perspective, it is a very important issue to everybody. And I think it's really interesting now because particularly we are in the era of sexual harassment, Me Too, and the huge prices that women have, you know, paid for that. And I thought it was really fascinating that your research showed that the voters expect the women candidates to have very definite ideas and to not duck these questions, that they should be ready and giving absolutely policies. And I think that was quite interesting, that rather than kind of like, well, that's a sidebar, that's women stuff, we don't want to talk about that, it's quite the opposite.
Right. Voters expect women to be prepared and polished and able to show up and impress, and they hold them to a very high standard along those lines.
Yeah, but also I think that with just the sheer number of women that have been coming forward, that I think people have really seeped into their consciousness that this is a very serious problem. And in their own lives, perhaps it's happened to them or their mother or their wife or their daughter or their sister. And I think that it's become no longer something that can just be dismissed. I think it's really been raised to a level of consciousness that I think a lot of people think that it's actually not only holding women back, but that perhaps it's affecting, keeping our whole society back.
Right. No, I think that's a really excellent point. I'm not sure if it's as widespread. That would be wonderful, because we still definitely find that there are a lot of naysayers and doubters in our focus groups. But what's really been heartening to see is that the conversation has changed. And I think that that is absolutely right, that these issues are taking center stage in a way that they previously never have. And that's been really fascinating to watch.
And I've been really fascinated, Amanda, because you have your organization has looked at a lot of governor's races, particularly. And if you think about it, in a way, a governor, to run for governor is kind of a stepping stone to running for president, if you will, because it's unique. You're voting not just for a member of Congress or a member of a body, a collegial body, but you're looking for a head honcho, so to speak. And I think it's a little discouraging, actually, that the number of women governors has really not increased. Increased that much, has it?
Well, it's definitely increased since Barbara started this work in 1998. And you're absolutely right. Barbara's dream, before she even started this foundation, Barbara Lee is our founder and president. And she would tell people that she wanted to see a woman in the White House, and people thought that she was nuts. And this was only 20-something years ago. And she had the same opinion as you, that a governorship is a clear-cut path to the presidency. And when she found that women face additional barriers when running for governor and really any executive office, it's absolutely what you said. It's one thing for voters to support a woman to be part of a deliberative body like a legislature when she's going to be a decision maker. But if she's going to be the decision maker, essentially CEO of her city or state, she has to work even harder to prove to voters that she's up to the job. And we all know that President of the United States is the ultimate executive office and the ultimate decision maker.
Yeah, but it's hard if you don't get into office to prove that you can do it. You know, I mean, in other words, you might have all the attributes, and I think it still is discouraging that, again, back to the qualifications, that if a man just have it on his resume, and he's had the attitude from the start, you know, well, it's expected he's going to run. That's always been in his agenda, if he's really that ambitious and that skillful. But for the woman, she has to prove it. And again, I repeat the obvious, that if you can't get the chance, you can't prove anything.
You're right. But on the flip side of that, what's been heartening, because I think it's very easier for us to all get depressed looking at all of these challenges that women face, what's been heartening is to see that when you look at most of the women that ran for office in the past 2 years that broke records and made history, most of them ran for office because they saw the impact of an issue. Something directly affected their family or their community and activated them into politics. Like you said, the majority of women that were elected recently were not groomed for a career in politics their whole lives. A lot of them had other successful careers in completely other sectors. And so what's been exciting is that voters respond well to women candidates who ran because they saw the impact of an issue. And that's because voters value authenticity, and they value women that are in touch with their lives. And so they can appreciate a woman who was activated into politics because something affected her children or her parents or her sister. And so that's been very interesting to watch as a fairly more pronounced trend. Women have always run for office to solve problems, but it seems like the problems have seemed a lot more urgent in the past few years.
Yeah, and I think it's really, it's kind of a sad state of affairs that I think in many ways our politics at the national level particularly, and in many states, has gotten pretty contested and pretty dysfunctional. And I think people are getting so frustrated. And in a way, I think that they see that there you've got over half the population and they are not representative fully. And so in a way, it's kind of an easy step to say, well, maybe we need some more women. Maybe, you know, and then they see that maybe women have a slightly different approach to solving problems. They tend to be more, you know, collegial. Then we tend to more think it out and listen to each other. And that I think people, I think there's been a real switch in this nation that I think people are far more willing to think, well, things have gotten really bad, and I think we need a woman who will have a slightly different approach to try and help us work out of this. Do you sense that feeling deep down?
Yes. And we did research actually at the end of 2017, right around the heightening of women's political activation, kind of in the wake of the Women's March and when a lot of women started running for municipal offices, and found that exactly what you said, voters on both sides of the aisle were fed up with the status quo. And if they believed that women served differently when in office, they were more likely to support a woman candidate. And we found that women on both sides of the aisle had advantages with voters. And then we sort of saw that play out in real time in the 2018 election cycle with so many women getting elected to office.
Yeah, and I think this year is going to be really, you people must be really almost salivating at all the research you're going to get this year, because it's already fascinating. And I'm finding quite a bit of the speeches, quite a bit of the, you know, the campaigning already that the women are doing. It's really been kind of fascinating to follow them. And you people must just be really excited, aren't
well,
you?
Well, I'm going to pod this down because we're almost to the end of the interview, and I do want to, Lisa, I found it kind of interesting, didn't you?
I absolutely did.
And I'm waiting for Arlene to come in with an announcement, because there's an important event occurring February 28th, and Alan Lipke's film documentary and is going to be shown, and I'm sorry, I don't have all the data right in front of me. I know Sean has it, and I know Arlene went out to find it, but I don't think she's going to make it back in time. Anyway, I'm going to ask Sean if he would get that information for sure to be announced, because I think it's a very very important event. And you have been listening to WMF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate all you listeners do. And just keep it tuned all day. It's really worth it. And so let's go back out with Laura Nero, because hopefully she will save the country. At least I hope so. I don't know. Anyway, let's give it a go. Oh, it doesn't want to go right now. That's not the one I want. So anyway, just a minute here. And again, don't forget the event that's going to be tomorrow at Mirror Lake Park in St. Pete, 5:30. And come on, play it, baby. Well, I guess it's not. I just one sec. And so anyway.
I think we got some help.
Oh. Well, I'm going to put the news on, but it's I Am the River, I Stand Screening, time 6 p.m., doors open, screening 7, Hillsborough County, CTA Hall, Tampa, 3102 Habana. Thank you so much.